Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Hello, and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I'm truly honored to share the microphone with the most interesting people. Now, these are people who are business leaders, they're authors, they're speakers, they're web developers. They are people who have challenged and absolutely overcome those challenges to become the wonderful entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, and business people that they are today. They also have wonderful stories to share, and they are here on this podcast to freely share their journeys, their business wisdom, tips, and best of all, actionable advice. In short, they are here to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And in fact, my guests are so compelling and so insightful that this podcast was cited on Inc.com as one of the best business podcasts you need to be listening to, and has also been mentioned on Entrepreneur and MSNBC. And our topic today is an important one: how women rise, break the 12 habits holding you back from your next raise, promotion, or job, with my guest, Sally Helgeson. Now, Sally Helgeson's work is widely regarded as the gold standard when it comes to women's leadership. Since the publication of The Female Advantage in 1990, which is still in print, by the way, she has written 5 more books in the field and speaks to audiences all around the world about these issues. Her latest book, How Women Rise, was co-authored with Marshall Goldsmith, and it explores specific behaviors that get in women's way as they seek advancement and offers powerful solutions to help women realize their full potential. I have the book on my desk. Grab it, read it, study it. Her clients have included Microsoft, IBM, Johnson & Johnson, Prudential Financial, Pfizer, Textron, Hewlett-Packard, and many, many more. She has led seminars at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and Smith College, and her work has been featured in Fortune, The New York Times, Fast Company, and Business Week. Sally, good morning. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. It's exciting to have you here.
Thank you, Denise. It's wonderful to be here.
Listen, I'm messing with my buttons here. Can you hear me?
I can't hear your buttons. I can just hear that you're doing something else.
Well, I just realized I still had my ceiling fan over, and with this headset, people can hear my fan, and it's a little annoying. So I was trying to mute myself, apparently I cannot multitask. I was trying to mute, turn off the fan and swat a cat out of the way, but here we are.
I've secured my cats and dogs already. That's part of my pre-podcast prep. I do it every day.
I can't. With one of mine, Hamilton, his hashtag on Facebook is Hamilton is an ass, is so loud. I swear. If I put him in a bedroom, which is across the house, you can hear him on this podcast. I let him do what he wants.
Exactly.
Anyway,
yeah.
I just pay the mortgage.
Exactly. Yeah, and feed him. Yeah, my cats tend to like to enjoy. They're very curious about podcasts, so I got to get them out of the way.
Well, they're a lot of fun. But listen, before we get started, tell people anything that I might have missed that you think might be relevant to this interview today.
Well, I think you got the gist of it. This book, How Women Rise, co-authored with Marshall Goldsmith, who, by the way, as many of your listeners probably know, has been the number one rated executive coach in the world for the past 8 years. This book focuses on behaviors that are likely to get in women's ways as they seek to rise. That is, as they work to become more successful, whether as entrepreneurs or part of an organization or part of a, consortium or group of organizations, even if they're entrepreneurs. And the premise here is that some of the same behaviors that can serve you well earlier in your career can start to get in your way as you become more successful. So in How Women Rise, we identify those behaviors and share from our combined, I do not want to tell you how many decades of experience that both of us have working with women leaders and aspiring women leaders all
right.
around the world.
And can you give us some examples? Because I have a reason for asking this, Sally, is that I work with a lot of people across this country and other countries. I work globally pretty much these days. But I tend to work with solopreneurs. And I guess some of my questions, just so you know, may be slanted towards that group
yes.
of people because you know, that's, of course, who I'm very interested in. But I've also found that many of us who are entrepreneurs, solopreneurs now, obviously had to start somewhere. Very few of us just woke up one day and said, I'm 8 years old, I'm going to have a lemonade stand, and I'm going to be the president of a corporation. We had to go through working with other people or for other people or walking out of other people's offices or, in my case, skipping out. I did. I skipped all the way down the stairs. I couldn't get out of there quick enough.
Yes.
But you know, we all have our journey. So are there any kind of examples that you can give us that, you know, that help us with those 12 points? Because many of us, I have found, I will go back to the very few days that I did work in other people's businesses. I have owned my own businesses most of the time. And I have to tell you, Sally, I didn't learn much.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't. And I don't know if that was just because I hated being in that position or they're just, maybe they weren't good leaders. I don't know. I'm curious to see why I missed so much other than get me the hell out of here. You know, that was my
overriding
thought.
Yeah,
yes.
That was the overriding. Well, you know, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs, and many of them were fortunate to learn a lot before they went out on their own. And you're exactly right. You know, becoming an entrepreneur, particularly for women, is rarely a step that is made at the very start of a career, although I would say that is to some degree changing, you know, again, as the technology becomes so much more accessible and makes so many different kind of micro or mini-micro enterprises possible to start at the beginning of your career. So I do see that changing. One of the things, this book has been really interesting. I want to give a little bit of background in terms of how we developed it and then address your question specifically about entrepreneurs because I think it's important. And I have been working with women leaders for many decades. I developed my mission really has for about 30 years been helping women to recognize, articulate, and act on their greatest strengths. And also helping organizations develop more inclusive cultures. And I had been doing some workshops, mostly within organizations or partnership firms, and they were really working well, and I was trying to work with being intentional in your career, intentional about your career development. And I was using Marshall Goldsmith's fabulous book, What Got You Here Won't Get You There, which is about the behaviors that get in the way of successful people. And one of the things in working with the women, it was very apparent to me and to them that some of these behaviors were not terribly relevant necessarily for women. You know, for example, I think behavior number one in that original book was learn to apologize. And you know what? Every one of us knows women who cannot open a door without apologizing for the very existence, it seems. You know, learn to talk about how great you stop talking about how great you are was another behavior. We know women who have a very difficult time really even speaking about, you know, what they've accomplished, et cetera. So that's when, you know, I said, Marshall, we need to take another cut at this when it comes to women. So that's how Women Rise came into being. One of the things that's been really fascinating, I've had two reactions from men. One has been, boy, does this help me understand the women I work with or for. It really helps me in terms of that. It's useful in terms of coaching, in terms of talent development, in terms of mentoring, et cetera, et cetera. All the things that people are interested in these days. But the other reaction I get is, boy, some of these behaviors are really, I identify with them, especially, you know, behavior number two, which
from
we have,
men.
Which is, yeah, expecting others to spontaneously notice and value your contributions. I hear from men who are, you know, physicists or engineers or have a lot of technical expertise in something, who really identify with this. So part of what I've come to conclude is that these are human behaviors, but they are just the behaviors that are most likely to get in women's ways as they seek to rise. Now, when we're talking about entrepreneurs, it's very interesting. The behaviors that we have in the book around expecting others to spontaneously notice and value what you're doing and being reluctant to claim your achievements, those are not generally behaviors that are going to be problematic for entrepreneurs because they couldn't get off square one if those were problems for them. Anybody, and I include myself, and I'm sure this is true for you as well, anybody who starts something up on their own has got to learn to get comfortable with drawing notice and value to what you're contributing. So that
absolutely. We have to toot our own horn until other people help us with it.
That's exactly right. So, you know, if you have that reluctance, and I say I had that reluctance from the time I was young, but as soon as I went out on my own, I saw that that's going to make it absolutely impossible. That's a barrier to, you know, the most basic entry. So I was able to let that go. When I do programs where there are a lot of, because I've been doing lots of, you know, events and leadership, basically 3-month book tour here, but doing a lot of events, and when I do events where there are a lot of entrepreneurs present, the subject that seems to get the most interest from them, and especially from the people who work with them, has to do with perfectionism and the trap of perfectionism.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yep.
When,
oh, boy.
Is that ringing a bell?
My hand is waving in the air. Call on me. I'm guilty of it. I try to overcome it every single day. It's bizarre. Logically, I know better, but I architect things in my head. I mean, when I'm building a website or I'm creating a social media marketing plan, I literally architect it in my head. I can see it. It's almost, you know, like I take one of those big screens and start waving my hands around and whip things into shape. I can see it. But when I sit down to actually do it and write it out, perfectionism comes in. It's like, I don't think that was in my head. Let me go back. It's annoying. It's also very dangerous.
It's very dangerous because it's dangerous for a couple reasons. One is that, you know, it tends to be unrealistic. Whenever we undertake a project, we do it in iterative stages. It gets better. We can't birth something that is absolutely perfect to begin with. That's the reality. So,
and
you know,
see, that's unreasonable. I find that just unreasonable.
I'm sorry, you're a human being because you're stuck with that as reality.
You know better. Get over it. No. And I have to
Exactly.
You know, the baby talk with myself.
And, you know, it's understandable. What we're doing represents us. I mean, we're creating something in the world, and we want it to really reflect our very best and our best intentions and our best skills and our best way of serving the, you know, customers or clients we're trying to meet every day. So that it's so understandable because we're so heavily vested in it. Why, it would be, you know, we would be trying to make it perfect. But there are three things I think that are so important for an entrepreneur who has these tendencies, and most entrepreneurs I know, men or women, to some degree do. It's really important to understand that it is iterative, and you'll get it right, and then you'll get it more right, and then you'll refine it again, and then it will be a work in process. And if you try to make it perfect the first time, first of all, you'll get stuck, and secondly, you will be operating. You will be spending, you know, an enormous amount of time without enough information and feedback, because once you put it out there, then you begin that process of getting information that allows you to improve it and tweak it. So you're really keeping yourself stuck. And so that's, you know, one of the problems. And there are two others, if you want to talk about them.
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah.
I'm writing notes. Because, and you're right. I mean, I finally had to stop saying, quit hugging it to your chest until it's just right, because you don't want to put something out there that's not perfect. You don't want to be embarrassed. You don't want to hurt your brand. And you're right. I would get stuck to the point where I would abandon a project.
Yeah,
and just
exactly.
Go on to something different, which, of course, is remarkably silly. But I would do it. I don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
But, boy, it took some talking to myself to get past that.
It's really the Achilles heel of entrepreneurs is that perfectionism. And it's the one, as I said, again, when I'm speaking to entrepreneurial groups, this is what gets the most resonance and the most interest, men or women, particularly women perhaps, because they often feel they have more to prove, but you see it everywhere. But there are two other problems with it. One problem is the amount of stress that you create for yourself and for other people. In terms of for yourself, that commitment you've got, you know, if you're starting an enterprise, you're running an enterprise, you're wearing 50 different hats, you've got a huge job to do, you're extremely busy, and you don't need more stress and perfectionism, because it's like a radar scanning the environment for every little detail that may be less than perfect. And that puts you under a lot of stress, because you're never in a place where you kind of take a breath, step back, feel good about what you did. You're always under a remarkable amount of stress. I got a great lesson. My co-author Marshall Goldsmith, I mentioned, you know, that he's considered the world's top executive coach for the last almost decade. You know, works with the most stellar CEOs all over the world. And working with him on this book was a very instructive thing, because he really does not put himself under needless stress. It is remarkable to witness, and I'm going to share a story with you that was very helpful to me in addressing my own perfectionism. Marshall and I
keep going. Don't stop.
We were working at his – he has an apartment in New York City. I live in the Hudson Valley, north of New York. And I'd go in and we'd spend a long day working. And we were working one day, and his assistant called from California, which is where his home and office are. And I heard him on the phone, and he said, oh, I was supposed to call him at 2, Dr. Kim, okay. I didn't make the call. I'll call him later. And he hung up, and he looked at me and he said, oh, well. And I thought, now I happen to know who Dr. Kim is. Dr. Kim is Dr. Jim Kim, who's the CEO of the World Bank. And I'm trying to put myself in Marshall's footsteps and think, if I had missed a call I was supposed to make to the CEO of the World Bank, would I have said, oh, well? Hardly.
I wouldn't. No,
hardly.
I would be excusing myself to you and saying I need a bit of time. I'll be back.
Right. And then I would have run out in the hall and started screaming. I would have thought, you know, I'm the biggest idiot in the world. What a jerk. Oh, my, I can't believe I did that. What's wrong with me, et cetera, et cetera. I would have really gone down that rabbit hole. So I was so fascinated by Marshall's response, which was, oh, well, he would do the same thing I would do. You know, he'll make the call. He'll figure it out. I'm sure he'll apologize, et cetera. But he didn't take it on personally. He didn't, you know, there was no kind of self-recrimination about that. And the next morning, I was up early, and I had an article being published in Strategy and Business magazine, really big magazine, which was a profile of a you know, quite famous business and legal thinker, and that I'd done. And I got an email about 7 in the morning from the editor saying, "Oop, we've got a mistake in the online edition. We have him born apparently in the wrong town." And there was an email from the subject of the interviewer saying, "I wasn't born in this town. I was born in that town." And I felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach. I thought, oh, my God, I can't believe I did that. You know, the magazine won't hire me again. This guy's going to think I'm an idiot, et cetera, et cetera. And then Marshall's words came to me. Oh, wow. And I thought, you know what? I can correct this. I can get in touch with the guy. I can find out where he was born. It's the online edition. It can be changed. It's not the end of the world. And I dealt with it, and I had no stress about it. And I walked into my dining room, and I printed out, I sat down at my laptop, printed out a banner, the biggest font my system will accommodate, that said, oh, well, and I put it up over my desk. And, you know, we are going to make mistakes. We cannot put ourselves under needless stress when we make mistakes. We've got to learn to say, oh, well, or whatever our version of it is. Life is too short, and we do too many things right to beat ourselves up over the wrong thing that we did. So we want to avoid adding needless stress. I could have started that day horribly. I had a busy day, and I had something go wrong by 7 o'clock in the morning. But I didn't take it on. I dealt with it, and I didn't go down that rabbit hole of self-recrimination, and because I recognized that, you know, I'm not perfect, and occasionally I get a small fact wrong, and usually it can be remedied. So it's really, really important.
That's important, what you just said. It really important, because we all miss appointments. We all make a mistake. We're like, oh, geez, oh, geez, oh, geez, oh, geez. And you can go down that rabbit hole, but the thing is, you apologize and you make it right, and then you move on. It's just logical.
Then you move on. And there's one other thing about the stress part for perfectionism, and that is that you put stress on other people. And I think this is super important for entrepreneurs. Do not put stress. You know, when you're a perfectionist, you usually not only expect perfection from yourself, you expect perfection from the people who you have working for you. This doesn't mean you want incompetent people or people who can't cut the job. You need people who are good. You need people who are good to succeed. But if you have perfectionistic expectations, then you probably are also going to have them of other people. And many of them will recognize, and I've heard people say this, you know, oh, she's so hard on us. She's even harder on herself, something like that. But guess what? That doesn't matter, that you're even harder on yourself. People don't like to work for someone who's unrealistically perfectionistic. I've been doing the work I've been doing for 30 years. I have never heard anybody say, I work for a perfectionistic boss and I love it. Never, never once. And as entrepreneurs, we are also, most of us, bosses in some capacity or other. Even if we're a one-person shop, we use other people, you know, whether it's for tech support or, you know, for website design or whatever it is, we employ other people. And having perfectionistic expectations is really problematic in terms of being a good boss and a good leader. And I think it's one of the reasons that so many entrepreneurs who are terrific at what they do do have reputations as rather poor leaders of people.
That does make sense. Listen, when I first started out, there was nobody to teach me a darn thing. I just knew in my heart and my gut that I was never going to have a job. I had just gotten my computer science degree. I refused to go work in somebody else's shop. That was never going to be for me. So I went out and I started doing websites, honestly, pretty much for free, just to build a portfolio. Mm-hmm. And I worked my hiney off, and none of them were perfect because this was back in 2000, 2001. We didn't have all of the wonderful tools that we have now, WordPress, GUI, graphical user interface. None of this stuff existed, but I didn't care. I was never going to work for somebody else again. I mean, my attitude is, you want coffee, get your butt out of the chair and go get it. I'm not your girl. So I run with scissors. I don't play well with others. I need to be off by myself, which I have done. And honestly, the biggest thing that held me back was perfectionism, because I could see in my head what I wanted. It had to be perfect. I couldn't launch it on an unsuspecting world unless it was just perfect. And I realized later rather than sooner, to my deep chagrin, that my biggest roadblock, if you will, was me, and that smarted. Yeah. But I finally figured it out.
Yeah. And that will really do it. So we've got stress. And we've looked at the sort of unrealistic idea of perfectionism, that you can get it right, you know, all at once, as opposed to it being a process that you build over time. But the third thing that's such a career killer and such a business killer when it comes to perfectionism is that really perfectionism makes you reluctant to take risks, because perfectionism and risk are sort of opposite behaviors when you think about it. Perfectionism, you're focused on getting all the details right. With risk, you usually have a big idea, something kind of bold, and there's no way you can, if you're going to be concerned about it being perfect, that's going to get in the way of your acting on that sort of big ambition. You're going to stick with what's doable, with what's safe, with what you've done, and get it ever and ever and ever more perfect rather than thinking in terms of risk. And one thing we know, certainly in organizations, an ability to take measured, intelligent, but bold risks is what is valued at the very highest level. Precision and correctness are not necessarily what is going to get you to the CEO position. Having big, bold ideas and being willing to act on them and coordinate resources to support that is what's going to get you to the highest level. And I would suggest that when you look at the history of most successful entrepreneurial efforts, risk has been a tolerance, a measured and intelligent, but very clear tolerance for risk is always going to be part of it. Now, there's always the financial risk of going out on your own. That's a risk, and all of us have to get comfortable with that unless we come at it already set up with resources. But it's also the risk of doing what you need to do to keep yourself ahead of the curve, whether that's in the kind of clients you look, you're expanding your client base, whether that is adapting a new technology, et cetera, et cetera. So that ability, you know, that no risk, no reward is really true in the entrepreneurial world. Perfectionism is something that's really going to prevent the kind of risk-taking that, you know, is intelligent and can be rewarded. You need always to test out when you've got a bold idea that's a departure, you need to be able to test out without overcommitting resources. Is it possible that this could work? Is there a way we could make this work? Would this work? But that really puts you in that sort of skunk camp, experimental frame of mind where you're trying something and taking measured risk. And if your standards for what your for this brand new brainchild are really high and it has to be perfect, you're not going to do it.
Been there, done that.
Yeah.
It's sad. It really, it's very sad. So when people read your book, are they going to find some specific things that they can do to overcome perfectionism?
Oh, absolutely. What we have, I mean, I think one of the reasons the book's doing very well, How Women Rise, and it's so resonant. You're seeing it everywhere, and it's selling very well, and, you know, we're inundated by comments on LinkedIn. Both of us are, both Marshall Goldsmith and myself are active on LinkedIn. And I think that one of the reasons is because since we also come from a coaching background, it's very specific in terms of addressing behaviors that get in your way. And there are four steps, and we really talk about it in the book because we've got 12 behaviors. We set them out. We give examples of how they get in people's way. And there's certainly other behaviors here, you know, ruminating, which is allied to perfectionism, that can get in women's ways. Those things, you know, are we lay them out. But we also offer a template for addressing behaviors that get in your way. It starts with identifying one thing, choosing one behavior or even one part of a behavior and saying, okay, I'm going to work on this. And it could be, say it were perfectionism, it could be, you know, I am going to work on being, you know, more tolerant. There may be someone who works for you who's actually very good but makes some mistakes and you've got a dicey relationship with her or him. You can say, I'm going to work with being a little more, not even tolerant of mistakes, but approaching mistakes that other people who are working with me may be making from a point of view of this is a teaching opportunity of how can we talk about this, how can I mentor or example, you know, provide an example of a different behavior. So choose, be really specific in when you're going to, where you're going to start. If you wake up one morning and say, I'm no longer going to be a perfectionist, you're probably doomed to failure because it's just too big a
bite
to take
off. I tried that.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't work.
You can't do that. You have to choose a situation where it's showing up and where it's really, you know, starting to get in your way that's very highly specific and could be around one person, one incident, one kind of behavior. You know, hey, I'm going to be presenting at the, you know, such and such conference about my business, and this time instead of, you know, putting myself under so much stress by staying up three nights in a row in order to make the perfect presentation, I'm going to practice. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to get a bit more relaxed and not try to focus so much on that perfectionism. So choose one thing. And then when you do, and this is going to be hard, and I got a feeling it's going to be hard for you, and I got a feeling it's going to be hard for a lot of the solo entrepreneurs who are out there and who are people who like to do it their way. And this is the most important thing, and this is one of the things I've really learned from Marshall. Don't try to do it alone. When you're trying to change a behavior that is ingrained and that you know is getting in your way and you really want to make an improvement, don't try to do it alone. Enlist help. Ask other people, hey, I'm trying to be, you know, what is it, a little more relaxed in my presentation. I'm trying to be more patient when someone is working with me, presents a problem, whatever that behavior is. You know, I'm going to be doing this. And then you ask somebody who might be there or who you could ask to be there, could you watch me and see how, you know, see what you think might be getting in your way? Inviting somebody to serve you in a situation as a kind of peer coach. One thing about entrepreneurs, most of them don't have the budget for a super-duper executive coach, which is, it's just not, you know, really good coaches are really, really expensive. We don't have anybody paying those bills. So most of us don't have the opportunity to have our own coach and a behavioral coach. But we can enlist other people, people who know us, people we trust, or even people who we don't know that well, but that we have some degree of trust. Will you watch me in this situation? I'm trying to get better at X. And then give me some feedback. And when that person gives you feedback, you know, don't make a comment on it. Don't take it personally.
That's right.
You know, it's hard to get feedback that's unsolicited. No one likes it. There's nobody. You know, there are no words any human being dreads more than when somebody comes up to you unsolicited and says, "Can I offer you some feedback?" Actually, no, you can't. I didn't ask for it. But when you ask for feedback, that's when you really want to make sure you don't take it personally. You ask for it. This person is trying to help you. And you don't push back. You don't say, "Oh, well, the reason I said that was because," you know, there's no buts here. Somebody offers you feedback. You just say, "Thank you. I appreciate that." That's helpful. Maybe not even that's helpful. Just because maybe it isn't helpful. You just say, "Thank you." And then you move on. And then you think about it. And then you get other people. So enlisting other people, and this is the power of Marshall's own method, enlisting other people, getting other people to give you their feedback on very limited things, not like, "How do you think I am as a boss?" But, you know, in this situation, I've had things go south because of X. Would you just watch and see how you think that's playing out? Or you could go to somebody who, if you're working on a specific behavior, who you think is really, really good with it. You know, say you're giving a presentation and you find yourself, you know, kind of uptight because of you know, it feels very high stakes. You go up to somebody who's very relaxed about their, you know, sharing publicly what they're doing, and you can say, "You know, you know, I really admire your presentation style. You're very relaxed, but you don't seem like you're winging it. Do you have any, you know, are there any tips for that I might use? Because I feel that I want to get better at that. I want to get more comfortable with it, so I'm not putting myself under so much stress." So, and I think this is especially the truth. I have to say, what we're talking about here, not trying to make these changes alone, is probably both especially important and especially difficult for anybody who's an entrepreneur, because, you know, we're motivated by that desire to shine and sort of be the, you know, be the special person and be the person who comes up with a brilliant idea that really helps the world, and that we don't have to be accountable to other people. When you're talking about that you wanted to get out of having a job, I mean, part of the reason that many of us didn't like having a traditional job, and I was the same, is we didn't want to feel like we had to be accountable to somebody else. But we do have to be accountable to ourselves. And in fact, we do have to be accountable to our customers and our clients and the people we work with. And, you know, we have a range of people. So I think that when you enlist other people, you are really, it's a way of holding yourself to account and say, "You know what, I actually really do want to get better at this behavior." You know, say your presentations are a little all over the place. "I want to become more concise." You go to somebody who's very concise and say, "Boy, you're crisp and concise, and you get a lot of information across in a very short time. Do you have any, you know, how did you learn to do that? Were you always like that, or was it a process?" So that kind of leaving yourself open, there's a little bit of vulnerability in that, But enlisting people and really thinking about, you know, how can I get value from the people around me by using them as peer coaches and having them hold me accountable for some of the changes that I really need to make. And it's a very powerful approach. So I think, you know, and then there are two other parts to this behavioral template we have. One is to let go of judgment, whether it's of yourself or other people, and, you know, this little bit of the oh well type of thing. And then also to remember that the you know, the habits you're trying to work on, the behaviors you may be trying to change, are also behaviors that have served you well, may have served you very well in the past, and that are to some degree responsible for the success you've had. So, you know, using that kind of template, which we set out in very highly specific actionable steps in the book, How Women Rise, I think that's, you know, one of the most valuable aspects of this book.
That is brilliant. It really is. I've been sitting here just very carefully listening, and I wanted to go back to something you said about, you know, getting people to kind of critique you or help you or offer advice. One of the best examples I can think of right now is when people are writing new books, because I'm writing one, it's top of mind about, guess what, podcasting. But I had a title that I had in my mind. It was a working title, but I was practically married to it. I loved it. Put it out there on Facebook, and nobody liked it. I was like, what the heck? I was like, darn it.
So, you're supposed to like my title.
Yeah, I'm practically engaged to the darn thing. Come on. But nobody really liked it. It simply did not resonate with my audience. So we put out a couple of different suggestions. One was from Craig Ballantyne. One was from Brad Zales, who's a good friend of mine. And it took a combination of the two to come up with the final title. And you'll see this a lot, peep covers, and they'll put them up for a vote.
Yeah, they'll do it on SurveyMonkey.
I've been
solicited dozens of times by friends
with books.
Exactly. Yeah.
And, of course, we want to say, oh, I really like that, or how about a different font down here? I'm getting ready to put my book covers up for exactly that. Saw one the other day where a guy, very, very well-known man, put up a book cover, and nobody got it. I didn't get it. And he ditched it and went in a completely different direction, which now makes sense. So, you know, that's just a good example. You know, ask your networks. You know, some of them are very much your peers. But if nothing else, I mean, you may stick with your original idea, but you will have been warned. So you've got nobody to blame but yourself.
Yeah, exactly. You may tweak that. You may end up with that original idea but tweaked. Or you may...
Right.
Get a better understanding of why your original idea was actually very strong, and that will help you think in a new way about the market you're trying to reach or what kind of, you know, marketing plan you might have, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you know, it's really all information, and if we can take that sort of pain of making ourselves vulnerable and a little bit the embarrassment. I mean, I remember when that happened to me. I did a book with Barry Kohler publishing in San Francisco, and they used SurveyMonkey for every single title every single book title that they do. And I had a title very much like you, and they put it out on SurveyMonkey, and I thought, well, what do all these people know? It's my book. But, you know, guess what? What we came up with was a heck of a lot better than what I had. Yeah, so I think that it's that opening. This thinking about this really started for me. I belong to a group called the Learning Network that Marshall started about 25 years ago of mainly, you know, consultants and solo practitioners in the leadership space. It's a very small group, and, you know, we've grown very intimate we're in our 21st year now being together. But about 10 years ago, he came back and he came to one of the programs and was all hot on the idea of peer coaching and enlisting peer coaches as somebody to hold you accountable. And when I left our network meeting, I decided I really needed to do that. It was a difficult time in my career. You know, it was the recession. It was in the early part of the recession, anybody who does what I do, speaking, writing, workshops, consulting, and coaching, many of us just got flamed in that recession. It was very challenging, and it was it's emotionally difficult. And I decided I really needed to work on a couple things that that if I could address, probably would have made the experience of that recession less less frightening and dangerous for me in terms of my business and my personal life also. So I enlisted a peer coach, somebody who's also a writer, who's a friend, and we started a practice where we, every month or every 2 months, we each identify one thing we want to work on, really work on, and then we formulate a little list of questions about it so that we'll be able to find out if, you know, from the other person, you know, hold us to account. Did you do this today? You said you were going to be working on this. And if you're going to be working on this, you're going to be doing this. Did you do this week? And we've been doing peer coaching 2 to 3 times a week now for 9 years. And I have to say I would not be where I am now if I hadn't done that, because when you work with someone like that, they really get to know where your, you know, weaknesses are. They can hear it in your voice when you're going to make a judgment, a bad decision that's the kind of bad decision you make, or you're leaning in a certain direction. And it's very, very it's very powerful kind of relationship. I think it's also really good to have a peer coach in terms of taking some pressure off your partner. You know, I would constantly ask my husband for certain kinds of advice, and I get very frustrated with him when, you know, I didn't feel like it was the right advice, even though, you know, he has a real, you know, he has a different kind of rhythm and template than I did. So having a peer coach, having somebody who's, it's kind of semi-professional, because they're doing, you know, they're, what's in it for them, you're helping them too. So it takes some of that pressure off, I think. It's a really, really healthy thing. I can't sing the praises or benefits enough of having a peer coach.
I do it. I have a peer coach, accountability buddy, mm-hmm. business partner, whatever you want to call her. And we started our Thursday calls a year ago. And I'm telling you, unless somebody's house is on fire, we don't miss those calls. Yep. And even then, we might go, hang on, we'll be back.
Yep.
Yeah, they're
exactly,
so,
you know,
so
yep.
important.
Yep, on vacation at Madrid, I'm getting up at 5:30 in the morning and walking down the hall with a cup of coffee to have that conversation. I'm with you. It's very, and I do think that especially for entrepreneurs, because it is so difficult what entrepreneurs are trying to do. I mean, it's just, you know, people say that all the time. They say, oh, I'd love to do what you do, but, you know, I don't have the stomach for the risk, or, you know, but I like being part of a team, or, you know, I can't structure my own day or what I'm doing. You know, we have to do everything. It's very challenging. And I think that I'm really glad to hear you say that. That accountability buddy, that peer coach is really more important for us, I think, than almost anybody.
It really is. And I think I mentioned at the top of the show, when I started out, there was nobody. You couldn't find a coach. There were no mentoring programs. They did not exist, unless maybe locally. But I wasn't aware of even that, in particular in you know, my degree field. And I just kind of winged it and did which is fine with me. You know, I can do a lot of things on my own. But over time, I realized that perfectionism was a problem, and I'll ask you a question about that in a bit. But I also had to become a lot more open and a lot more vulnerable, or I was going to bed exhausted, defeated every night. But then I'd wake up the next morning and go, woohoo, off we go to go do it again. So one thing about entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, we can't do it any different. We don't want to do the regular, we're driven to do what we do. And we can make it hard or we can make it easier. It really is a series of choices about how we structure our day, structure our work, structure our messaging. So having that call with her every week, I'm telling you, and one time she was in Kentucky. She was in the middle of this huge event, and she could not make the call. And I get this text from her the next morning. She had no sleep. This event was monstrous. And she said, I miss talking with you. I know. I really felt like my day on the Thursday simply was not complete because we hadn't checked in. We did via text a bit, but that's not the same thing as having our hour-long, okay, let's do this. What about this? Oh, that's a great idea. And just supporting each other. So, yes, it's important to
supporting,
find that
but also
person.
Questioning.
Yes.
Supporting, but also
yes.
questioning, saying, you know, I think I remember, you know, and, you know, as I said, we've been doing this 9 years. You say, I think I remember, you know, 3 years ago you had a similar idea and, you know, this is what happened. So you want to think through. Here's the thing, you know, this whole, there's so much now about intention and purpose. And, you know, finding the purpose in your work. Well, entrepreneurs don't have to struggle to find purpose.
No, we have to struggle sorting it all out.
Right. Yeah, we have it.
Winnowing it down a bit.
Got it. And that's huge. That's a big deal. It's very motivating. We don't have to usually struggle to find that point of engagement. We are engaged. We are motivated. This is who we are because there's a point of confluence between what our identity is as people and what we're doing. So we have this huge gift and advantage to start out with. But translating that purpose into being very intentional about the development of our self-development, our career development, and the development of our enterprise, the different ways in which we can take it and move it, that's harder because it's such a tsunami of work and opportunity that being able to sort through that in an intentional and even enlightened way is where entrepreneurs tend to run into trouble. And, you know, there we all manufacture tons of opportunities. So being intentional about which ones we decide to pursue and why we're pursuing them, how they fit into the overall larger scheme, that's the rub. And it's one of the, you know, reasons that having someone hold you to account. And I don't want to just peer coaching is essential to me, but I think also engaging, you know, this practice of getting other people involved in helping you make important decisions, whether, you know, it's a book title or a venue for a meeting or, you know, the wisdom of pursuing a certain kind of new client base. I think just, you know, bringing people in and asking for feedback in a really highly specific way is a great practice. And, you know, being an entrepreneur, it's lonely. It's, you know, there's a degree of loneliness in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So you know, being, you know, and usually you're a person who doesn't necessarily want to be part of a pack, but having
No, I don't. I'm an introvert big time, but every once in a while I'll say, you know, I think I'll go to the grocery store so I can see people.
Seriously, no, exactly.
I've done that.
Yeah. I live out in the country, so it's like, have I seen anybody but a squirrel today?
You need both.
So it's difficult.
Okay, I wanted to ask you very quickly, and this may or may not point back to perfectionism, and it may be just part of we are overwhelmed. I don't know about you, but I am constantly turning away things that just really may not fit with my business plan or And I will often say, I don't take a client just because they showed up. You have to like your clients. You have to practically get to know them, especially with the work I do. You have to be very careful and very intentional. But here's what I have found, and maybe this is just intuition kicking in or good business sense or a combination of the two. But if I have started to take on a project or I'm thinking of taking on a project and I wake up and I feel reluctance and it's battering at me all day, get out of it. It's the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, I agree with that. Most people who are entrepreneurs are people who are fairly intuitive and whose sense of intuition is pretty developed, and it is it helps them. And you know, there's an old phrase in the South. They say, "Trust your first mind." Yep, trust your first mind. And if your first mind, if you feel consistently reluctant about something, which is why it's a good idea to approach things provisionally. You know, let's see how this will work. Let's test this proposition. Let's test working with this client. This is a different kind of thing for me. It might be interesting, but let me test it on a very, very limited basis so that I can give myself room to pull out of it gracefully and constructively without, you know, getting involved and saying, yes, let's do this, and then waking up the next morning and thinking, you know what, I really don't want to do this. You know, that can lead to problems and vulnerabilities down the line. But I believe that strongly, and I've been in that situation, you know, where I signed up for something and then I realized, wait a minute, that does not serve. Here's what I'm trying to achieve with what I'm doing. And that I don't know how that adds. It's an interesting opportunity. It sounds like a lot of fun. I'd probably meet a lot of cool people. You know, I get to go on this big junket to Brussels or Vienna or London or whatever. But guess what? I'm not sure how this is going to, at the end of the year, pay off with what, you know, with what I'm really trying to achieve right now in this frame. So I think that, you know, that hazard of, you know, being overwhelmed by opportunity, it takes a lot of discipline. It takes discipline to be able to turn down opportunities that are exciting and that look good. And it also takes discipline to be able to structure your time without getting overwhelmed, especially, you know, given the technology that we all interact with right now. And I think that's especially, you know, when I work in organizations, one of the things that I often advise for people is, you know, to be your own HR department in terms of setting your own policies and practices around how your interactions with people, with technology, in terms of meetings you accept and don't, how well those really serve you in terms of being productive. And that's tough to do often in organizations. You need a little bit of leverage and power to be able to do that. But one of the great things about being an entrepreneur is you really can do that. You really do. You can and must be your own HR department. So being intentional in how you use your time and technology and interact with it, and you know what you respond to and what you, you know, I never think it's good to blow anything off, but when you know something's not right for you, to respond in a very clear way, you know, not justifying it, but, you know, just, I don't think this is the right opportunity for me right now. End of story. You know, not, but let's circle back in 6 months because you think that sort of softens the blow. No, that doesn't help you, and it doesn't help the other person. So I think that being very clear and, you know, not justifying, not minimizing, is a real service you can do for yourself, and something you
I agree.
Should get good at, setting those boundaries, being very clear.
No is not a word that I have problems with. My mother actually insists that it was my first word, not mom, not dad, not mom and dad. It was no, and an emphatic no. And in fact, as far as I'm concerned, the word no can and is used as a complete sentence. But you know what? We did not get to, and I wanted to ask you this, the 12 habits holding women back, because I wanted you to kind of go through those if you could. I suspect that we need an entirely new episode for that. Would you be willing to come back?
I would be willing to come back. We
okay,
could do
good.
It sometime this summer. We could do it sometime
good.
This summer.
And if you would like to have Marshall join us, that would be wonderful. Maybe we can chat with both of you. But Yes, let's get you back on because I really do want to talk about the 12 habits holding women back. And we may have touched on the skills and the habits that make women successful early on that can really be holding them back later. But if we didn't, we can definitely get to that. And
yeah,
then just,
that would be great.
Okay, great.
We've tended to focus here particularly on entrepreneurs, of course, and on perfectionism, because that's something that is so problematic for entrepreneurs, particularly.
Right.
Although it's a problem for women often generally. But yeah, I'd love to do something where we focus and go through those 12 habits. I think, you know, what we've come up with is very powerful, useful, and as I said, actionable with this template. So I appreciate that and would love to come back.
Great. Well, you've got the link, so you can just go ahead and schedule in whenever you've got time, July, August, whenever you've got more time. But Sally, before I let you go, where can people find you on the web?
Well, that's important. SallyHelgeson.com is my website, and there's a contact button there. My email is Sally@SallyHelgeson.com, and I, as noted, am active on LinkedIn, so please feel free to connect with me there, too.
Definitely. Sally, thank you so much. It has been a great pleasure speaking with you today, and I really thank you for all the wonderful tips and the advice that you've shared with our audience. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us in iTunes. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Sally, thank you, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you, Denise. It's been a pleasure.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeonthe.web.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on Your Partner in Success Radio.